Hello, I'm Luke Broadwater, State House reporter for the Baltimore Sun.
And I'm Malia Cromer, pollster and political science professor at Goucher College. And this is Roughly Speaking, Government Edition, a Baltimore Sun podcast where each week during legislative session, we take a closer look at the policy, people, and places that shape our state government.
This week, we're going to talk to Delegate Eric Luedtke. He's a Democrat representing District 14 in Montgomery County, and he's chairman of the House Democratic Caucus.
But first, we're going to take a look back at the Baltimore Sun reporting from this past week. Well, we turned the clocks ahead this weekend. Daylight savings time. Woo! but for members of the General Assembly and reporters who cover them, it seems like that you won't be seeing the light of day from any time between now and sunny die. Is that right?
Yes. So it's just getting busier in Annapolis. We're quickly approaching what's known as crossover day, which is the deadline for bills to move from one chamber to the other. There are exceptions to this rule, of course, but the general rule of thumb is if your bill hasn't passed your chamber by March 18th, it's not going to pass. So we're seeing a lot of scrambling from senators and delegates to move their legislation this week before the deadline. Now, of course, like I said, if let's say some bill comes in at the last minute that both Senate President Miller and House Speaker Bush want to pass, they could pass it in a day, folks, if they really want to. But generally, if your favorite piece of legislation that you're watching in Annapolis has not moved by next Monday, by this coming Monday, then chances are it's probably going to die this year.
Well, that sounds like a lot of fun. From the Sun's reporting, it looks like it was a really emotional week at the State House. Can you tell us what happened and what that might mean for the rest of the legislative session?
It was. There were some really soul-searching moments in the House of Delegates last week. And to bring us up to speed on the latest with the medically assisted suicide legislation, which I think caused a lot of those emotional moments, that debate, let's bring in my colleague from the State House Bureau, Pamela Wood. Hey, Pam.
Hey, Luke.
So, medically assisted suicide has passed the House and is moving towards a vote in the Senate. And the debate in the House got very heavy. Delegate Eric Luedtke, who is going to be on our podcast this week, gave a speech that I think had people looking deep within themselves. Let's listen to a clip of the Montgomery County Democrat.
I think we all recognize that this bill raises some pretty deep moral questions. And for me, it's been a very personal issue. So for many years, I opposed this bill. And then, as many of you who've served with me for a while know, in 2014, my mother was diagnosed with stage 3B esophageal cancer. It is a type of cancer that does not have very good outcomes. And we watched as, despite the best efforts of her doctors, the pain became unmanageable. She did not die free of pain. She died in extraordinary pain. And a few days before she died, I walked into the kitchen, and it was one of the last times she got out of her bed, and she had taken the bottle of liquid morphine that had been prescribed to her, and she tried to drink it to end it. Because of that pain, because of the humiliation she felt, as a very proud person in having to depend on us in those final days. Despite my personal hatred for suicide, I began to ask myself what right I had as a government official and even as her son to dictate to her how her life should end. What right do any of us have to determine that for another individual?
So, Pam, this was a moment of great introspection for many of our lawmakers and I think many Marylanders. How was this speech received in the chambers?
Yeah, it absolutely was an intense debate. It was a somber debate. The House can sometimes be a little bit of a rowdy place. I mean, there's 141 of them, but it was just absolutely quiet in there. As various lawmakers made their case, and Delegate Lutkies was by far the most compelling. Whether do you agree with his position or not, there were delegates weeping as he spoke. You know, others had their heads down, you know, on their desks. Some were kind of looking up at the ceiling. It was absolutely riveting. I mean, when he talks about, you know, finding his mother, you know, trying to end her life, it just really hits you in the gut. Everybody, I'm sure, probably thought about, you know, their mom in that moment. And it really was one of the most compelling things I've seen in Annapolis.
Now, I noticed quite a few Democrats, especially ones who described themselves as perhaps more religious, joined the Republicans in voting against this bill. So this debate really didn't break down along strict party lines.
No, it really didn't. There were crossover there. In particular, as you noted, some African-American delegates objected to this bill kind of on religious or moral grounds. Some of them stood up and spoke. Delegate Jay Walker from Prince George's County was one who said, look, this is for God to decide. This is not for us to decide, or, you know, doctors and patients. This is a higher power controls when we live and when we die, not ourselves. And that was a theme among several of the Democrats who voted against it, and a lot of the Republicans as well. There's definitely a strong faith component to how people perceive this legislation.
And it passed by just 3 votes.
Right. It was 74 votes in favor. So with 141 members, you need 71 to reach a majority. So they had 3 to spare.
And now what are its prospects in the Senate?
So the Senate sponsor, Will Smith, told you that he thought that this gives him momentum, that it faces good prospects in the committee. But he predicted a tough debate on the floor of the Senate. So we will be watching to see how that turns out.
And I'll say this for myself. There were several moments during that debate that left me feeling kind of messed up. Like, I think so.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people left that way.
Yeah. And you know, one of the things is that there's a lot of people deride politicians and lawmakers and think they're wasting their time or that they're not taking things seriously. And this was an example of how much they all care very much about what they do. And both people who voted for and against had really thoughtful reasoned arguments, you know, supporting their view. And they took this very seriously. You know, that's your government at work.
Okay, let's change topics very quickly. I also wanted to ask you about the Handgun Permit Review Board. There was some passion during a committee meeting on Friday. What's the bill about and what happened at this hearing?
Yeah, somebody got thrown out of a committee hearing on Friday. So the Handgun Review Board is if you apply for a concealed carry permit for a handgun, you go to the state police. If you don't like the state police decision, you can appeal to this Handgun Permit Review Board. It's 5 citizens appointed by the governor with consent from the Senate. And in recent years, under Governor Larry Hogan's appointees, the board has grown very permissive. They are routinely overturning state police decisions when they've denied giving people permits. And they also often drop the restrictions that the police put on permits. So there's a bill that would abolish the handgun board entirely, so that if you don't like your decision from the state police, you would appeal to an administrative judge. Now, this is opposed by Second Amendment advocates, gun rights advocates, one of which, a woman named Shari Judah, who used to be on the handgun board, she testified against it, and she was very strident.
Upon hearing of the possible passage of SB 1000, I felt both a moral obligation and a civic duty to testify against this bill. I am compelled to address the inaccuracies that have been perpetrated by the media recently, specifically in an editorial in the Baltimore Sun on February 7th entitled "The Handgun Board That Couldn't Shoot Straight."
She was yelling through her testimony.
The effort to abolish the Handgun Permit Review Board is more than an attack on the board. It is an attack on law-abiding citizens who are simply seeking to defend themselves and following the lawful process to do so. Marylanders seeking a handgun permit deserve. You're a disgrace. You give people one hand.
And kept going after her time was up and after she was asked to conclude. And when she didn't, a state trooper came down, grabbed her by the arm, and hauled her out of the hearing room.
And there was a ton of interest in this video online, right? I mean, thousands and thousands of people were watching it.
Yeah, I believe at last check, our Facebook page had, our video had over 64,000 views on it. It was shared widely on message boards and on Facebook. There was video from the hearing itself. They're all live streamed, so you can sit at home and watch it. And a lot of people actually were watching it. And then I caught some video of her being taken out, which you can't see on the, you know, the General Assembly video. So, you know, there's mixed thoughts about how the Ms. Judah was handled and treated and whether it was appropriate or not. So it's definitely been a point of discussion.
And so do you think now that Democrats are poised to abolish this board?
You know, it's hard to say whether they're going to pass this bill or not. Last year, there was a bill to abolish it that was changed, and they didn't end up abolishing it. So we'll see if there's different thoughts about that this year.
Pamela Wood from the Sun's State House Bureau. Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, now to talk about a few more topics concerning legislation in the General Assembly, let's bring in Baltimore Sun investigative reporter Catherine Rentz. Hey, Catherine.
Hey, Luke.
You've been doing some outstanding reporting concerning rape kits in the state. Can you talk about what you have found through your investigation and how it is influencing legislation in Annapolis this year?
Sure. Well, it all started in 2016 when a young woman named Catherine Beckett emailed us to say that she found out her rape kit was destroyed. And I, like a lot of reporters, often get emails about this or that, looking into this. This one was really well researched. It was very personal. And so I said, well, let me just see if this is a one-off thing or if this is more of a trend. So I sent a survey to several agencies around the Baltimore area, and I found out, wow, this is not just a one-off thing, not a mistake. Police agencies are regularly destroying rape kits. As early as 3 months, sometimes, you know, a year, especially in Baltimore County. Baltimore County was destroying more of them than any other agency in the region. So we found over about a six-year period between 2010 and 2016, at least 250 rape kits were destroyed. Most of that was in Baltimore County, about 175, as I recall. So it's important to know that in Maryland, there's no statute of limitations, but for some reason, agencies were destroying them, a year after they were reported. So what often happens is women like Catherine Beckett decide after they go through therapy and they digest it a little bit more about what's happened, or if they're triggered by something in the news, they'll say, I want to reopen my case. I want to prosecute. I want to find this guy. And that's what happened here. She was actually triggered by another story in the news at the time, Brock Turner. Which was making national news. He's a Stanford swimmer who raped a woman in California. And so she was triggered by that, came forward, wanted to prosecute, but realized soon thereafter that her evidence was destroyed. So we did a story looking at how many rape kits are destroyed and why are they doing this. And Shelley Hettleman, Delegate Shelley Hettleman from Baltimore County, saw it. She was extremely disturbed that Baltimore County was leading the region for destroying rape kits, while other agencies such as Montgomery County Police, Baltimore City Police, other places have decided, you know, no, we're not, you know, long since decided we're not going to destroy any rape kits because women can come forward later. So she passed legislation in 2017 saying police agencies, you have to keep rape kits for at least 20 years, except for a couple of exceptions that are pretty rare, like the suspect is dead or the suspect has been convicted and already served their time. And so that passed in 2017. And so the other investigation we found, you know, also came from people telling us about these issues with rape investigations where police detectives were using these waiver forms. So these forms that they would give victims who were reporting a rape that said, police, I excuse you from investigating my rape, or you don't have to prosecute. And what we were finding after looking a lot into these cases is that these were given to women not all the time, you know, like days after or months after they've had time to investigate the case and look into it and decide, you know, we can't go after it. These were given a lot of these cases. These forms were given to women in the hospital as they were about to have a rape kit or right after they had their rape kit examination. And this is probably the worst day of this person's life. And if you are a police asking a woman to, you know, to participate in an investigation, you're telling them what all that entails. A lot of women, most of the time, will say, I'm not interested, because they just want to get rid of the case. They don't want to think about it. And as a result, this perpetrator stays, you know, in on the streets and, you know, can serially offend, as we have found. And so they'll sign this waiver form. And it's something that is the International Association of Chiefs of Police has said, don't do this. Back since about 2005, when they initially set out some recommendations about how police should investigate sexual assault, they said, do not use these waiver forms because they can be seen as a way to intimidate women not to participate. Like, we don't believe you. Please sign this form that you're not going to sue us for not investigating. And so I spoke to the person who she used to be the head of sexual assault investigations in San Diego, and she helped write that policy for the International Association of Chiefs of Police. And she said she was actually using Baltimore County's waiver as an example of what not to do for years because it was so bad. And because if you read it, it says something like, there was not intimidation. There was not, you know, any kind of force and used in making this victim sign this form. And she said that is actually a form of intimidation itself. Mm-hmm. It's really bad. So as I did for the first one, I went around to different agencies to see, is this a thing? Are agencies doing this more than just a few times? And I was astounded when I found out how often Baltimore County was using it. You know, again, number one user of these forms. And so as I was talking to some experts in the field, Lisa Jordan with the Maryland Coalition Against Sexual Assault, and Shelley Hedelman again of Baltimore County, I have never heard such strong reactions. They were irate when they found out how many times these forms were used and how Baltimore County was leading the agencies in using them.
And what did the police say why they were doing this?
So the police say that their explanation is that oftentimes it's used so that women know they don't have to participate in an investigation, and that they are doing this so that they know later on that it wasn't the police decision to not investigate this, that it was actually the victims. And they just want this in writing to show that this was the case. Well, the experts I spoke to, I put that to International Association of Chiefs of Police, among other sexual assault investigation experts. And they said, well, you can just put that in the police report. You don't have to have a victim sign this. Mm-hmm. And so when I put that to Baltimore County Police after I spoke to Lisa Jordan and Shelley Heldman, they apparently called the Baltimore County executive and police and told them to stop immediately.
Right.
Which they did. They immediately stopped.
Absolutely. They immediately acknowledged what they were doing was bad practice and wrong. And I have to say, as an observer to these investigations, I've noticed how quickly, once they were published, change came about, right? Like the one on the waivers, I mean, it was like hours, and Anne Arundel was changing policy.
Right.
So they were having immediate impact.
Right. No, it was for Baltimore County, it happened before we even published. Mm-hmm. It was, when I spoke to Delegate Heldman and Lisa Jordan, I mean, that policy was ended, like, I want to say within 48 hours.
Wow.
And then for Anne Arundel, so we published the piece that day. Senator Sarah Elfrith, who represents Anne Arundel County, she's a new senator, she called the county executive, the new county executive down there, Stuart Pittman, and that was stopped within hours, too. So within hours of publication, then Anne Arundel's like, okay, we're going to stop this. So interestingly, the one place where it's still – they still use the waiver for victims is Harford County. Mm. In Harford County, the sheriff, Gaylor, is elected. So he does not come under the sway of the county executive there.
Mm-hmm.
And so I am still working on, they have told me why they use the waivers. They say it's rare. And I'm still working on getting access to the files to see, exactly what happened. How soon after reporting the rape did these women sign or these victims sign these forms?
And then meanwhile, the legislation on rape kits is moving forward. A bill just passed the House last week, 140-0, to provide funding to test all these kits now that you reported are going untested moving forward.
Right. So again, this started back in 2015, actually, I want to say, when then Senator Karen Montgomery from Montgomery County was hearing from women saying, police aren't testing my rape kit. They're not taking us seriously. Montgomery, among other people, started calling around to police agencies trying to get the number of untested rape kits, not getting it. Police were just telling her, we think, we treat these cases very seriously, but she wasn't getting an answer. So she passed legislation in 2015 requiring an audit of untested kits. And that revealed about 3,700 untested kits across the state. So these weren't kits that were put on the shelf and forgotten about. And most of the cases, the police just didn't feel like they needed to test the kit for one reason or another. In Baltimore County, for example, they do not regularly test kits where the suspect is known. And it's more of a question of consent. So there are reasons. Many experts may disagree with the reasons why they weren't testing him. But anyway, fast forward a few years after the legislation that Delegate Heldman passed saying you can't destroy these kits, the untested kits keep growing. So now we have close to 7,000 untested kits. And the General Assembly has been looking at how do we fund these? What do we do with these? They set up a committee back in 2017 to look at exactly that. Like, what do we do with all of these kits? How do we fund them? So they set up a committee, run out of the Office of Attorney General. They just concluded we need to test nearly all of them, and we need to set up a separate fund to do that. And so that's what essentially they are doing. They've set up the legislation that you mentioned. Looks like it's likely to be passed, where there will be about $3 million set up to pay for the untested kits going forward. Separately, they also got a federal grant to help pay for the ones that have already, been on the shelves for years. So a lot of those will be tested as well.
Catherine Rentz, I know you got to run to another interview on your next investigation, so I won't keep you any longer, but thanks for coming on.
All right. Thank you, Luke. Appreciate it.
Okay, so last Thursday, a majority of senators from the Baltimore City delegation endorsed legislation to create an armed police force at the private Johns Hopkins University. This issue, of course, has become not just about whether a university should have a private police force, but has driven conversation about the larger issue of policing in communities. Luke, what did you find out?
Well, yes, the Hopkins police bill cleared a large hurdle last week when the city's Senate delegation passed it 3-2. I say that because normally delegation votes aren't the be-all and end-all of a bill. But in this case, if there was a place to kill the bill, it was probably the city Senate delegation. That's because actually two guests of the show, Senator Mary Washington and Senator Jill Carter, are both against the bill, and they were no votes. So all they needed was one more city senator to join them, and they could have voted it down. That said, what happened instead of voting it down was the bill was amended heavily. Senator Corey McCray and Senator Antonio Hayes both put in a slew of amendments to, in their view, make the bill more palatable. For instance, they're requiring 25% of officers on the force to be from Baltimore. They put restrictions on about where the force can patrol. They boosted more money for communities around the campus, and they required the oversight board to be subject to Senate approval. So those are just a number of the things that they've done to try to temper this force in some ways and make it so it will pass. I will say, once it gets out of the city delegation, it's likely to sail through the rest of the state. I mean, it has widespread support. I mean, you saw that in the JPR committee last week. It was a 3-2 vote in the city Senate delegation, and then it's a 9-1 vote in JPR. And that includes like some pretty liberal senators. So the issue here with the Hopkins policing issue, if it's going to be, is most contentious among city lawmakers and city residents, not to the rest of the state.
And really contentious among those progressive activists. And you see all the complaints about this issue. It really is coming from a really vocal a group of individuals in Baltimore City who are, frankly concerned about the levels of policing in their communities.
Absolutely. And, and I think that Baltimore may have not a totally unique, but a more pronounced relationship with the police and with regard to police corruption. I mean, we have had some of the biggest police corruption scandals in America in the city of Baltimore. So there's a unique distrust of police in Baltimore, and there's also a feeling that we have too often, as a society, have looked to police to solve our problems instead of looking to investment in youth and housing and health and other investments. So this debate is very heated and very pronounced in Baltimore. And it's only moving forward because I expect it to come to both chambers perhaps this week.
And finally, the Maryland Senate continues to vote down some of Governor Hogan's bills. The week before last, it was the bill to increase tech schools in Maryland. And this past week, it was two tax breaks for retirees. Is this partisan politics, budgetary reality, both, a little bit of something else? What do you have for us, Luke?
Well, so the Democrats who control the General Assembly are very desirous to come up with funding for the Kerwin Commission recommendations. There's a bill working its way through Annapolis right now to provide $325 million more in funding for the next budget and $750 million for the budget after that. Now, how do you come up with the money, right? So one of the ways is Governor Hogan baked into his budget a bunch of tax cuts. I mean, something it's like $500 million of tax cuts over 5 years. And if you want to fund increases to education, you can't fund the tax cuts too. And so it's about choosing priorities. You know, the governor's priorities and Republican priorities are to lower taxes for different groups. These are targeted tax cuts, so a lot for retirees. And the priority of the General Assembly leadership is to increase education funding. Both House Speaker Mike Bush and Senate President Mike Miller have said that education is their number one priority. So that's where that falls down. I mean, I'm sure it makes some of these things a little easier that they're the governor's initiatives. I'm sure if it was like a Mike Miller initiative, it'd probably have an easier chance of passing. But there really are budget realities. You do have to come up with the money for tax cuts somewhere and the money for schools somewhere, and something has to give.
Well, the people did vote in a divided government with a Republican governor and a supermajority Democratic House of Delegates and Maryland Senate. And I think what we're seeing right now is that sort of desire come to fruition. All right, let's move on to our guest, Delegate Eric Luecke. Welcome to Roughly Speaking, Delegate.
Thanks for having me. I've been listening every week.
Wonderful. So on Roughly Speaking, we like to get to know the district as well as the delegate. So can you give us the greatest hits of the 14th? What do our listeners need to know about where you represent?
So I represent a district that has three sort of discrete areas: Burtonsville, Olney, and Damascus, all in northeastern Montgomery County. Burtonsville's more working class and diverse. Olney's wealthier, whiter. Damascus is a very rural community. Got a lot to see in District 14.
Wonderful. Okay. So I think that you and I have only met each other once before in person, but we regularly interact with each other on social media. I describe our Twitter relationship as friendly poking, and sometimes I react to your commentary with an eye roll emoji. But there is one topic that you post about that makes us very much kindred spirits, despite our different perspectives on hashtag MD politics. You love Maryland State Parks. In fact, you and your family are trying to visit all the state parks in Maryland. How's that going?
Well, we have done 7 so far. We've got a lot more work to do before the end of the year. There's 63 units managed by the State Park Service. So I'm a parks geek. I'm an outdoors guy, and I'm having a lot of fun with it and seeing places that, even though I'm a lifelong Marylander, I've never seen before. So that's been really cool.
What is one place that you've seen that you really enjoy that you would highly recommend any listener to go and spend a day with their family at?
So as many times as I've been up to Garrett County to see the Deep Creek area, I went to Deep Creek State Park with my girlfriend a few weeks ago, and we did this hike, and there's an old corduroy road on top of the ridge in the park, which is a road that's built out of wooden logs, and it's how they used to build roads 300 years ago. It was kind of cool to see, so I had a great time hiking that.
And what do you think the state legislature could do, or the Maryland government could do, to help protect and enhance our public lands in the state?
Well, I mean, I think the biggest thing is funding. I think the Park Service has historically been underfunded. We have a lot of lands that are actually owned by the Park Service but not open as parks because they can't afford the staffing for it. So, for example, I went with Senator Sarah Elforth to a park in her district, Franklin Point, which is in southern Anne Arundel County. And that only has trails on it and is open because of volunteers with the local riverkeeper that do it. So, you know, the biggest thing we can do to support the parks is make sure they're funded adequately.
Okay, I could talk about parks all day, but we need to talk a little bit about party and ideology.
Sure.
So you're a Democrat and a progressive, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Which one are you first, a Democrat or a progressive?
A Democrat. Progressive is kind of a loose term, and I think there's, you know, lots of arguments that go back and forth about what a progressive truly is.
So, and I'm asking this not to push this idea of like the fractured Democrats narrative, but I think it's because I think that's actually generally overblown, but not completely unfair, because I'm interested in whether sort of you lean towards more ideological purity or big tech party politics. Where do you stand on this?
Look, I'm the chairman of the Democratic Caucus in the House. I'm a believer that the Democratic Party is a big tent. We have some very progressive members. We have some relatively conservative members. They all have a place in the party, and part of what we have to do in the caucus is try to make sure everybody comes together behind the basic ideals of the party.
And what are those basic ideals? What are the must-have beliefs?
Well, I think fairness and equality. I think an economy that works for working and middle-class families. I think protecting the environment. I mean, these are basic ideals that we can all agree with, and we may disagree on some of the details of how to get there, but we're all behind the basic concept.
So is there room in the Maryland Democratic Party for pro-life Democrats? Are there any pro-life Democrats you know of that are serving in elected office?
I think we have Democrats in elected office that lean towards the pro-life end of the spectrum. I think there's room for that. I think the majority of the party tends the other way.
Sure.
But, you know, we have almost any issue, you'll see people on both sides within the Democratic Party.
Okay. And before I turn you over to Luke, I'd like to talk a little bit about relationships in Annapolis. So how important are they in advancing your legislation?
They are everything. Relationships are everything. There's 188 of us. You can't get anything done alone. And, the reality is, unlike D.C., we're a relatively bipartisan place. So you got to build relationships on both sides of the aisle. You got to build them in multiple committees and both chambers. And that's the only way to get anything done.
Can you give me a specific instance where you had an idea that would definitely not have passed if it wasn't for a little bit of help from your friends?
I don't know about not have passed, but I passed a bill a few years ago called Peyton's Law, which was aimed at grants to try to support schools buying robotics technology that allows kids that are sick to remotely access their classrooms. I cross-filed that with Senator Andy Serafini, who's a conservative Republican from Western Maryland. We got the bill passed, but then it needed to be funded in the governor's budget. And I don't have, that much pull with the governor. Andy does, and he managed to get the project funded.
Okay, do you have a best friend in the legislature?
Best friend in the legislature? I have a lot of very close friends in the legislature.
Sure.
Very close with Chairman Clippinger, Chairman Kaiser, who comes from my district. We're very close. Janelle Wilkins, my seatmate. So you tend to develop very solid relationships with people.
You have a favorite Republican?
I think the Republican I'm probably closest to is Jason Buckle, who sits on my committee. He's the
okay.
senior Republican on my committee, and we work really well together.
So, good. Yeah. That's some good bipartisan sort of flavor.
Absolutely.
Okay, so I'm going to turn you over to Luke. No more fun. You got to talk to Luke about the hard stuff now.
I can be fun too, Malia. So we're into the final month of the session. How do you think it's going so far? What were the major things you hope to accomplish coming in, and do you think you're achieving them?
I think this is the most productive session we've had since I came in. We're getting a lot of really great stuff done. I'm chair of the education subcommittee. My biggest priority is making sure we do what we need to do on education. And, the Kerwin bill that is being proposed is a fantastic step towards improving our schools. I think it is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to get it right with public schools. So I've been really excited to be a part of that conversation.
And I'd like to dive a little deeper into your testimony last week on medically assisted suicide concerning your mother.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of people, including myself, heard that, and it kind of messed me up listening to it, to be honest. And
me too.
Yeah.
It was a tough speech to give.
How difficult was that for you to share?
It was challenging. I mean, look, you suffer that kind of personal loss, and it's difficult to deal with it in the first place. It's even more difficult to talk about it or to talk about it publicly. So it was, I've been telling people, the most difficult speech I've ever given in the General Assembly. But I'm glad I did, because I think it touched people. It added to the conversation. So.
Yeah, I think, yours stood out to me, but there were a number of other people, too, that really... you could see people sort of bearing their souls on the House floor in a way you don't normally in politics.
Yeah, absolutely. The one that stood out to me the most was Delegate Sandy Bartlett, who was a cancer survivor, talking about her experiences. I don't remember that many debates that were that emotional on the floor of the House. The one that struck me as the most similar was the debate a few years ago now over marriage equality. One of the reasons I love serving in Annapolis is even though we may disagree, and we disagreed on that bill, there are two distinct points of view. That was one of the most respectful, profound, deep debates I've ever participated in. It made me proud to be a legislator.
You've introduced legislation to legalize marijuana mm-hmm. for adult recreational use in Maryland. And I think this is something a lot of Marylanders, at least the polling suggests, Malia, have wanted for years. What's the holdup?
I think it's a significant change, right? I mean, you're talking about something that's been illegal for – longer than most of us have been alive. And so it takes some time for people to get used to that idea. There's also a lot of details that need to be worked out. So, for example, how do we regulate the industry? What tax rates do we set? Who gets licenses? And one of the big questions for us from a racial equity perspective is we have this history of a drug war that is racially biased and that has disproportionately affected African Americans and Latinos. We can't just legalize cannabis and then let, you know, people who weren't affected by that benefit while allowing people that were harmed by the drug war to continue to be harmed by it. So we have to go back and do some restorative work to support communities that have been negatively affected by the drug war.
Yeah, you see this sort of insane imbalance after some of these legalization efforts where you have rich guys from out of state getting rich off of, let's say, medical marijuana, and you still have young black kids in Baltimore getting locked up for it.
So absolutely. Absolutely. And people who, you know, can't get a job because they have a conviction 20 years ago. And you know, it's a really difficult issue to figure out how exactly to deal with it. But I think it's a commitment we need to make if we're going to legalize cannabis.
You're a supporter of ranked choice voting.
Yes.
An effort by our delegate here in Baltimore, Brooke Learman, failed this year. Can you bring us up to speed about the effort in Montgomery County and where that is?
Sure. We got a unanimous vote out of the Montgomery County House delegation. So the House delegation, at least, has expressed its support. I'm not sure what's going to happen with the bill here on in. I think there's a lot of conversations happening about what the actual impact would be of ranked choice voting. There are concerns about some of the research that have come out of different parts of the country about its impact on turnout. And so those are things we need to think through very carefully. It is a significant change to how we vote.
And why do you think this is superior to our current system?
Because it eliminates the spoiler effect, right? You see a lot of people who don't run in the first place or who choose to vote for somebody that they're less comfortable with because they're worried about the spoiler effect, about a third-party candidate taking enough votes away from somebody to end up in their defeat. And, you know, I think it's a fairer system. It's a system that allows the voters to better express their true opinions. And so, you know, I'm intrigued by it. I think there's a lot of other voting reforms we need to be looking at, too. But I think that's part of the equation.
And then I've noticed you have a sort of you're one of the people in Annapolis who has sort of an esprit de corps with the rest of the lawmakers. For instance, I've seen you when a freshman passes a bill, you walk across the floor to give him a fist bump or something. I mean, you're like, do you see that? I know that you're the what's your title with the caucus?
The caucus chair.
Yeah, you're the caucus chair. So, I mean, do you see that as sort of your role is to sort of build this, this sense of camaraderie in Annapolis?
I mean, sure, that's part of it. But a lot of it is just I genuinely like my colleagues. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are people who take significant time away from their families and their jobs to try to make a difference. And again, that's both sides of the aisle. So I have tremendous respect for the people I serve with. I'm proud to serve with them. And, you know, it's an extraordinary job to be able to do.
And anything else you want to highlight for the listeners? Where do you see yourself going from here?
I am very happy where I'm at. I get to do great work on education. I was a classroom teacher, so I'm passionate about that. I've been involved in all sorts of significant changes that have affected regular people. I'm happy being a state legislator.
Great. Delegate Eric Luedtke, thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
All right. That's all we have for this week's Roughly Speaking Government Edition. And as Lukey would have it, Goucher's on spring break next week, and I'm heading to Zion National Park to do some hiking with my husband. But I'll be back after we cross over to the final stretch of legislative session. Please take good care of the podcast while I'm gone, Luke.
Well, I'm very jealous you're going to Zion. Zion's awesome.
I know.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite parks. Anyway, thanks for listening, everyone, and a special thank you to producer Steve Early and Hallie Miller. As we say each week, while times change, the need for quality journalism doesn't. So please subscribe to the Baltimore Sun. Thanks, and see you next week.